It's my great pleasure to welcome back to, for perhaps, gosh, you've appeared here many times,
mm-hmm.
Both singly or individually, as well as collectively with groups. So it's been a lovely journey that you've taken with us here at Many Rivers.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Teresa is the author of these books that you see on the table over there. In addition to the book she'll be talking about tonight, her latest, Welcoming Willith, of course, there are three other volumes over there, The Strega and the Dreamer, Stories They Told Me, and Ode to Manoa. So do check them out if you haven't seen them before. Teresa has has cultivated many aspects of an earthworker, and her work in connecting with her own lineage roots has been a fascinating one, and we are very much delighted to welcome you back to Many Rivers Books and Tea tonight.
Thank you.
And are looking forward to this talk. Thank you so much. Please join me in welcoming.
Thank you. Well, thanks for coming, everyone. Mm-hmm. Great. And it's always really nice to be down here at Many Rivers. I find myself too busy to come in a lot lately, I realize, and I've got to change that, so come in more. So nice in here. And congratulations on 12 years.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really amazing. Good. So tonight's about Lilith, and I think she means a lot of different things to a lot of people, but I want to bring to you what she's meant to me. And so I would like to just start by maybe we could all just, if it feels comfortable to you, to close your eyes and I'll just call her in for a minute and then give you a minute to also call her in quietly to yourself and any other question or reason why you came tonight. I guess we could all just take a minute of reflection on that. So I'm calling to this most powerful bird goddess, Lilith, who's an owl, who is a raptor. She's also known as a death goddess, the goddess that would lead you back to the place of origin when you die. And she's a very, very powerful female entity. So we're welcoming you here tonight, Lilith. And anyone who is your friend may join you as well. So I wanted to this book, Welcoming Lilith, it started 23 years ago, actually, this book, and it was it started because I had what I like to call a visitation. And so when I was thinking about what I wanted to say tonight, I thought, well, that's interesting. I'd like to just start by talking about this idea of a visitation. And I had never really thought about what that means, so I thought, well, I'll just put a couple things down on the paper about what comes to my mind when I say this word visitation. And then everybody can kind of be thinking about this. And I was thinking if we had time at the end and anybody wanted to share a visitation they've had in their life, that might be fun. Or if someone's really, you know, really dying to share it after I share this and my visitation, you don't have to hold it to the end. But so a couple of the things I wrote down is, what is a visitation? A visitation is a powerful epiphanic moment that may take a lifetime to reveal its meaning. And visitations are gifts. Do not underestimate the power of visitation. It's important to pay attention and keep listening, maybe all of your life. So for me, you know, this visitation I had 23 years ago by a great gray owl, that's why there is one on the table. This was my visitation. It's still with me, and I'm still trying to understand, you know, what all it was trying to say to me. And it was, you know, it was just so powerful, a moment in my life, that it still makes me wonder. You know, why do these things happen, and what's really going on? But I think keeping the wonder about it is part of the secret, too. So, what is a visitation? When a being or image visits you in a way that is so palpable and deeply layered with meaning to you that it transcends time and space. And so I think that's a really important thing about a visitation, is that it has meaning to you. It's really meaningful. It might not mean anything to someone else, but it's particularly speaking to you in the moment that it comes to you. It can be an animal, a person, an apparition, a place, a word, a feeling. It can be other dimensional, of this dimension, or both. In this case, for me, it felt like it was both. I mean, there was a physical owl there, but it was clearly, to me, it felt like some kind of spiritual being that wanted my attention. That could have just been the owl, too. I don't claim to know exactly what it was. When it happens, time stops, so that seems to be another quality of these visitations. Time seems to stop, and either it's going on for a really long time and you didn't realize it, or it feels like a really long time and it was just a couple of seconds. It's non-ordinary, or has the qualities of the non-ordinary in it. And I was just thinking, boy, I don't know what brings these about. That might be actually an interesting research project. Where do they come from? Are they parts of ourselves who come to remind ourselves who we are? Is it a part of our own psyche? Are they beings and allies that come to remind us who we are, why we're here? Are they our guides? Or is it just a constellation of energies and images that build up at important moments and become revelatory, kind of the way Jung describes synchronicities? So I'm sure many people have different ways to define them, but they're unique experiences and they stay with us. So the key, I think, really about these visitations is how to unpack them and listen to them and continue listening to them to try to, you know, keep them very potent in our psyche. So I'm going to read you my visitation, which is the introduction to this book. The cover art was done by a local artist. She was going to try to come tonight, but looks like she didn't make it. But she's done two of my, she also did the cover to Stories They Told Me. Suzanne DeVerve is her name. So this is my visitation. I was living in rural Vermont when my 29th birthday arrived. Western astrology calls this the year of the Saturn return, the time life purpose is revealed. I returned from a party very late at night. Being rural Vermont, there were no street lights. It was very dark. As I pulled into my driveway, My headlights illuminated a great gray owl perched on the fence in my yard. Great grays are rare in Vermont. It was very large and did not fly away. Mesmerized, I emerged from the car slowly and quietly and stood looking at the owl. Though I was quite close, the huge bird did not fly away. Our eyes locked in trance. The owl's eyes were huge yellow disks that I flew into, large nocturnal suns that knew everything. "What?" I asked, for I felt an urgency. "What have you come to tell me?" "Save me from exile and banishment," the owl said. What could that mean? I did not understand, but knew the message must be important. The owl flew up into a tree. I continued to watch it by the light from my deck. It stayed on the branch, looking down on me for a long time. That whole night I tossed and turned in bed. I knew this was some sort of visitation whose meaning I needed to decode. The owl would not let me sleep. The next day I looked in all my books. This was before the internet. For any information on owls and their symbolic meaning, I found that the owl is associated with hidden wisdom, secret teachings, and Lilith. Lilith? Who was Lilith? I had never heard of her. In my Webster's dictionary, I found an entry for her. Lilith, the first wife of Adam, before Eve. What? Adam had a first wife? I never knew that. I'd been raised Catholic. Apparently, this part of the Lilith definition was from ancient Hebrew texts. The next day, I took myself to the library and all the local bookstores. I borrowed and bought every book I could find on Lilith, or that had a reference to her. There weren't that many. I found quite quickly that I was dealing with a banished goddess and a forgotten reality of powerful ancient women. Thus the journey began. At age 29, I was already identified as a writer. Now my lens shifted. I set out to write a nonfiction book about Lilith and these concurrent issues, but midway through it flipped into two novels set in Bronze Age Crete about a snake priestess. Those are Ode to Manoa and Stories They Told Me, my Crete novels. The owl goddess Lilith appears in both of these novels as a character. I continue to research and collect data on Lilith. The following is the result of the effort I started 20 years ago. She is not an easy one to pin down. I believe she wants it that way. Her presence is vast, multi-layered and multidimensional. It is not to be diminished. The exploration in this small book is separated by subject into the many guises Lilith manifests in our culture, as well as how she is held in our psyches and collective mythology. This is only a start, an entry place for those who wish to know her, to welcome her back, to save her from exile and banishment in the world and within yourself. Take this beginning ride, then fly with her to where she wishes to take you. It will be different for everyone. A great fragmentation of the female psyche happened with the banishment of Lilith. Or one could reverse that to say, the Lilith story represents a great fragmentation still found to this day in the female psyche, in spite of all our advances toward liberation and equality. Which came first, the story or the fragmentation? Who knows? This book hopes to encourage the restoration of wholeness back to the female psyche as well as all things female in the cultural and mythological realms. Until we restore ourselves to wholeness, we will never experience what we currently call liberation and equality. So that's the introduction. And I wrote this book primarily for women, but I'm very interested to hear, you know, the male point of view on Lilith, if so. Please be forthcoming, because I haven't explored it, and I would just love to hear, you know, how you hold her, what you think of her. And So does anyone have anything to say before we move on to the next piece?
Did you encounter the owl another time?
I've never seen a great gray owl again in my life, except in, you know, like in a raptor center where it's in a cage. Because it really, when I was in Vermont, it didn't really belong there. I don't know what it was doing there, and I don't know if they're even around here. Do you know?
No, I don't think that.
Yeah. I think they're pretty far north usually. So, but other owls I've seen.
Yeah.
And if you go to Regal Park at sunset and go out in the meadow, you can really see owls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody else? So how many people? Oh, yes.
Seems quite a character shift from her to Eve.
From her to Eve?
Yeah.
Yeah. Really was. I would think. Yeah.
She's stronger. Not so suggestible.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, I was just going to ask how many people know the story of Adam and Lilith. So I included it in this book, but there's a little, you know, I kind of took liberties and rewrote it. So this is the story of Lilith and Adam and Eve, as told by me. Because after all, there's a lot of editing that needs to go on this planet, we know. Okay. Once there was a man and a woman born at the same time, in the same place, of the same materials. Their names were Adam and Lilith. They lived together peacefully for a long time. After a time, Adam decided that he wanted to rule over Lilith, but Lilith refused to submit to Adam. Being of equal origin, she saw no reason why she should. They began to argue, something they had never done before. Adam persisted. He even began to insist that she lie beneath him during intercourse. When she said no, he tried to force her. Lilith would not tolerate this behavior. She left Adam. Adam howled in rage so loudly that none of the animals in the shared environment could find peace. Finally, they approached Adam, inquiring about the howling. He reported to them that Lilith had abandoned him. Could they find her and bring her back? The animals found Lilith swimming in the warm waters of the Red Sea. She explained to them that Adam had behaved in a manner unacceptable to her. They told her that Adam was so lonely and his moaning was keeping the whole world awake. Would she please return to him? Lilith stated to them that unless he accepted her as his equal, she would not return. Adam refused her request. For a time, Lilith felt pain and loneliness, but she soon got over Adam, especially after she heard that he had a new wife, whom he was treating badly. Adam found a woman named Eve, whom he wooed with a story she found flattering about a male god who had created her just for him out of one of his ribs while he was sleeping. Since she was younger and less experienced than Adam, she believed him when he told her she was less of a person than him. In this, Adam found great power and satisfaction. He even got to liking that feeling and began to search around for other ways of acquiring it. Still, oftentimes, especially at night, he found himself longing for that strong woman Lilith. Although Lilith never returned, Adam knew that she could if she wanted to. He also knew that he had wronged her. Because of this, he began to fear her. Worried that she may actually someday decide to return, he began to spread lies about her. Eve was bothered by a feeling of duality. Right from the start, a sort of shadow lurking. Since Adam never admitted to his first marriage, she could never come to understand it. She dared not tell anyone for fear they may call her insane, but sometimes she swore she heard the voice of another woman speaking to her. She still didn't know what it was that could have possibly made her eat that apple. So. I think it's interesting that for any of us that are Judeo-Christian, you know, traditions, this is actually a story in our mythology. You know, that Adam had a first wife and he threw her out and got a new wife, and really very few people know about this first wife. And if you think about it, this theme is repeated over and over again in movies and stories. This first wife that kind of went insane because she couldn't submit or deal with what she was being asked of her, and the new wife that is kind of haunted by this other woman. It's really intriguing to start to watch how often this shows up in stories and art over and over again. So Jane Eyre is one of the books that's really prominent in, and that's actually one of the chapters in here about Rochester's first wife, you know, up in the attic, and haunting Jane at night, running through the hallways. And meanwhile, Rochester's asking Jane to marry him, and, you know, his wife's up in the attic. So it's pretty intriguing. So I thought I would just I just did some free writing, some things I believe about Lilith, and I thought I would just read that, and then I'm hoping that we have time I'll read one of these chapters, and we can do one of the rituals tonight, or it's a little, like a little exercise. We can do that together and share whatever comes up, and I'd also be very interested, you know, how this is for the men, this one exercise in here. But first I thought, well, I should tell them a little bit about just some thoughts that I have about who Lilith is. So Lilith is my biggest ally and guide. And it's interesting that she's got such a small book. Because it's much shorter than my other books, but the feeling was that just to give a little bit about Lilith, and I didn't even want to. There's a lot of bad press about Lilith. Okay, lots of bad press out there, and I didn't want to repeat any of it. I was like, why do I need to keep writing all the gossip and, you know, bad mouthing that's out there about Lilith? I'm not even going to include that in the book. I'm going to try to just address what I see as the qualities of Lilith that would really be worth our while as women, and however men want to interpret that, to bring back to this culture and not repeat those, you know, those horrible stories that they've told about her. But I mean, it's a little bit in here because I try to turn a lot of them around. Like one of the horrible things said about Lilith is that she's a child killer, and she comes into babies' cribs at night and suffocates them. And so I address it in the way that I say, really, she's the savior of stillborns. And the rumors got started because she was seen in the nursery when a child died. But she was really coming to rescue their soul and take them. So I just kind of address them sideways a little bit rather than really give the full bad press. So it seemed like it wanted to be a small book because it seemed like it was like, just give the reader a little bit and let them have their own journey with Lilith. Like, don't, you know, shove down their throat what you think. Let them go do these rituals and have their own interaction with her, because nobody can really, I can't really tell you who Lilith is because she's too big, and she'll be different for everyone. She's beyond description, really. my opinion. But she is my biggest guide and ally. And she's an ancient owl goddess who was once a powerful archetype. So long before Adam, you know, or any Judeo-Christianity was even thought about on this planet, Lilith was around and she was an ancient owl goddess. And she just got reduced into, this is just way, one of the ways that she got reduced by making her Adam's first wife. But she's in a lot of mythology, actually, not just Judeo-Christian. She's in the Sumerian myth of Inanna, and she's all over. Though powerful and respected when she was in her full power, she was not demonized. And there's a big difference in trying to understand how this happened to a lot of the powerful female, if you want to call them deities or entities. They were powerful and respected, and they were even feared, but they only turned into demons when they were no longer welcome. That's my opinion. Other people might debate that. You would not want to cross Lilith, you know? And I always say, you know, I mean, we need women like this on the planet. We need women saying, it's enough, you know? Don't cross here. Stop it. You're out of line. And so you wouldn't want to cross her because she's the one who can restore and bring balance. She is the one who will expose truths and shadows. And she's the one who will not allow violation and abuse. But she is not a demon. She's only demonized in a world where the voice of truth is not wanted, where bad behavior is accepted, and where some do not want her wizened gaze on them, for they know they are behaving badly. Lilith is our ally, all of us, men and women. She is a woman of power, a dark goddess who can hold all truths within her. She can hold the polarities in herself. Therefore, we do not need to split ourselves in half to stand before her. Integrating Lilith back into our lives is big but necessary work. She's also considered a death goddess. This is only frightening when we forget that death is part of life and that both are held within the body of the cosmic goddess, which is the universe. Wouldn't we want a powerful womb to come and collect us when it is time to go, to rock us back to the realm of creation in the safe container of her womb? Lilith is someone we want in our lives. It is my belief that Lilith holds many of the powers that are often currently seen as negative in the female. Anger, raw sexuality, truth-telling, being difficult. She's related to the blood cycle, the moon cycle. All of these qualities are truly our power, but because we deem them negative, we hide them. Also, because they are not integrated and welcomed into ourselves or our culture, they can often turn negative or feel negative, frightening, and feared. That is when they can indeed become harmful, when they're not integrated in us, when we're not comfortable with them. That's when they can feel difficult to other people. So this book explores some of these repressed powers of Lilith and offers rituals to help a woman integrate these powers into herself and become whole again. So it would be really fun to do this with a group of friends, I think, you know, do one ritual at a time together and talk about it. So I'm going to read the chapter headings. So chapter one is Lilith is a hairy woman, and that means she's hairy. She really is. She's often described when they're talking about her very fearfully. She's very hairy. And she's got really big hair, and, you know, things can get caught in her hair, and her hair is like this scary entity on her. And so the first chapter is about what does it mean to be hairy and in the real sense, and also what does that mean to be bothersome, hairy. Chapter two, Lilith is a bleeding woman, so she's, you know, not hiding that. she cycles with the moon and she can reproduce. So, and she lives in the Red Sea. That's where she lives, which I found very interesting also, because if you look at the map, the Red Sea really has the shape of a vulva, and it's red, and that's where Lilith lives. Lilith is a raging woman, and she's pretty pissed off, you know? And and this is really, to me, this is really something women need to deal with. Women really need to deal with their rage. So that chapter's about the anger and the rage, and that's the one where Jane Eyre comes in, and Bertha Mason, the first wife, who was pretty pissed off. So integrating this dark woman, integrating her into ourselves and owning our anger. Lilith is the muse. A lot of people who are very creative have a very deep relationship to a dark goddess, a dark woman. You okay? Lilith is a woman of power, and power is another big word for women to learn to be comfortable with. And what is women's power, really? Lilith is a black woman. She is black, and this chapter talks about how black has become associated with demonic often, and that whole misunderstanding of what blackness really is. Lilith is the shadow woman. That's the chapter we're going to do together. Lilith is a woman who exposes the truth. So she's not a nice girl, you know. She tells the truth, and she'll hold a mirror up to you. And it's another reason why she got demonized. Lilith is the savior of stillborns. Lilith is a sexual woman. So that chapter talks about how her roots go back to, you know, the Paleolithic, when women really saw their own sexuality in the earth, mirrored in the earth, and the power that they gleaned from that, and the understanding that of the power of being able to give birth and reproduce, and really having control over our sexuality. Lilith is a bird goddess. And Lilith is Strega. That's the last chapter. And I'm hoping to have time to read that one, because it took me 20 years to figure that one out. That was a long one. Oh, is that why you came 20 years ago? So, I think I have time. I thought it might be good to read this in this book, Ode to Manoa. It's set in Minoan Crete, and it's about a snake priestess. And she goes through a very difficult time of she gets bit. Okay, so she's a snake priestess in the snake temple, and every month she gets a bite from the snake, and she has a hallucination, you could call it, based on that. They're called trance dances in this culture. And eventually she collects these images she's receiving, and then she speaks them as prophecy. So that was the tradition in their culture, that the snake priestesses would offer prophecy to the community based on what the snakes were telling them. So her particular role in this culture was that she saw the future of women. So this took place in the Bronze Age. So this priestess sees our reality, and she's pretty disturbed. So she leaves. So it's very difficult for her. She sees the history of women. So she flees to a cave, and that's when she has her first interaction with Lilith. So I thought it might be nice to read this to you, because it'll give you another idea of the feeling of who Lilith was before she became demonized. Did anybody have anything to say before we go on? Okay. What?
I'm very intrigued.
Okay. It was a relief to stumble at last upon the cave. For days I had walked, the rains fell, cooling me through to the juices. My legs walked on, carrying me farther and farther. They stopped only to rest under trees whose large, drooping branches offered shelter. I did not see the cave until I fell forward into it. It was dark and raining. I had been fumbling along with outstretched arms for some time, then I toppled suddenly into it. I searched around in the darkness for some pieces of dry wood, which I gathered into a pile near the entryway. After repeated efforts, I was unable to bring them to flame, and so collapsed into sleep. In the morning, I was surprised to wake up to an overwhelming view of a meeting of the sea and sky. The cave sat up on a hill that looked down upon a rounded cove. The cove was surrounded by craggy rocks reaching into tall cliffs around it. The waters were so still within this hidden cove that it seemed to be an illusion. I would not let myself believe completely until I had walked down to the small sandy beach and put my hands into the wetness. The cave had a high, rounded ceiling. The floor was smooth, almost polished. One could easily see that the sea had once made her home within it. She was everywhere upon it in deposits of her creatures, imprints of their tiny bones. The floor sloped down toward the back of the cave. In the day's light, I was able to gather up more dry wood and some brush, which I brought to flame inside the cave. I sat in the opening, watching. In the distance, I could see the sails of boats passing by, reflecting against the wind. None came near. Within the cove waters were many tall rocks reaching up and out of the waters. They must have extended out into deeper waters as well, making it unsafe for boats. For 3 days and three nights, I stayed there alone. During the days, I wandered about, getting to know the area. On the second day, I discovered a steep path to the right of the cave, which led into a densely wooded area. This was the way I must have entered this place. I was able to forage, digging up roots and eating berries. My sleep was infrequent and uncomfortable. I woke up many times frightened, having revisited the places of my visions in the dream time. I would sit awake inside the dark coldness of the cave, the fire having gone out, and think about Barbara. So Barbara was her mentor who had passed away because the snake venom became toxic in her body. My body swelled with the loss of her. Her face, as I had last seen it, pale and drawn, hung stubbornly within my inner vision. I sat there night after night, remembering her, seeing her, wanting desperately to talk to her. One moment I would feel sad, the next angry and cheated, the next lonely. So many different feelings were running through me, tugging me in different directions. I was furious that it was the venom that had taken her, the venom she had taken from me. I wished over and over that she had not done that. I imagined scenes of myself not allowing her to do it, saying no. I was desperate over the fact that I had not stopped her. The Aurelia, the main character in the book, had a very strong response to the snake bite, so her mentor was trying to lessen that by sucking some of the venom into her own mouth, and that's what she's really regretting here. How could I have let her do that? I asked myself over and over. On the third night, as I sat in the opening of the cave watching the sun's slow and brilliant descent, I heard a rustling, the sound of a large sail catching the wind. In the distance, I saw something dark and mysterious flying toward me. It became larger and larger as it got closer. The sound was the wind upon its outstretched wings. This is too large to be an owl, I thought to myself, backing into the cave. She came to land in the entryway, a magnificent winged woman. Long, thick black hair, strong dark eyebrows, bright green eyes, beaked nose above small pink mouth, skin of copper red. She wore no clothing, exposing her breasts between two enormous feathered wings, whose span filled the opening of the cave. She had hairy legs and the clawed feet of an owl. Moss and cedar, her fragrance permeated the dense air of the cave. I stared at her, backing away until I reached the wall behind me and could go no farther. "Who are you?" I asked. "I am Lilith," she said, "keeper of secrets." She lowered her wings and approached me, looming very tall above me. "I have come that you may give me yours." "From where? From where have you come?" "From the future, the past, and the now," she said. I tried to back away farther, but there was nowhere to go. Lilith turned and walked toward the fire. She sat herself down in front of it, her feathered back to me. "I know," she said to the fire. "The form is difficult at first." I stood looking at her back, how the feathers, which from a distance had looked black and gray, were actually black and brown with flecks of white, how they hung around her like a shawl. "You will soon become cold in that corner," she said. "Come and sit across the fire from me." I walked to a place directly across from her, the fire between us, and sat down. "Your sleep needs guarding," she said, poking at the fire with a large stick, bringing up sparks. "For this purpose I have come." I sat up, watching her through the fire, until I could not sit up anymore and let myself lie down, and then finally surrender to slumber. My sleep was again fitful, waking me. Every time I awoke, I would see her sitting in the same place, awake, watching me, the fire blazing high between us. In the morning, as the sun rose, she left, flying away, her wide wings spanning the horizon. At sun setting, she returned, clutching food within her clawed feet. All through the nights to follow, she would sit across the fire from me. When my dreams woke me, I would sit up and stare into the red flames she kept burning tall. No words passed between us. Though the form I still found difficult, her dark, silent presence offered me comfort. One night I awoke in panic, gasping for breath. I tried to rid myself of the horrors of my last vision, which had replayed inside my dream time. I shook my head and covered my eyes. I stood and paced and circled on my side of the fire. "Tell it all to me," Lilith said, breaking the silence between us. "Tell me all your secrets. I shall hold them for you, that you may live a human life." So it was that I began to tell Lilith my secrets. Each night after I had eaten, I would sit across the fire from her and tell her a story. I started with the first vision, then moved on from there, closing my eyes to better remember. I could feel how the words that left me reached her differently, how the passage through the fire changed them, how they arrived to her polished, burnt clean. At first I was hesitant, not wanting to let them go, uneasy with their form after they left me. As we continued to work, however, a sense of relief became larger than that part of me that longed to cling. I began to look forward to my nighttime storytelling, yearning to reveal myself further, shed another layer. I could feel how Lilith absorbed them, how she was able to hold them within herself without becoming altered by them. Each time I would complete a cycle, she would nod her head and say, "This too shall come to pass." "Where do you go?" I asked her finally one night, "when you leave here." "My home is in the Red Sea," she said. "I go to attend to the many matters of my children." "Children? Have you many children?" "All who discover the murder of the goddess are my children. I come to assist them through this most difficult discovery. You, Aurelia, are my child." "Are there many like me?" "Many, and yet too few. There is much work to be done."
"Work?"
"Yes, work."
"What kind of work?"
"What is broken may be repaired," Lilith said. Then lo, almost in a chant, "Gather her many pieces, make her whole." "Gather her many pieces," I repeated. "Not gone forever?" "Nothing gone forever."
Of course, I said, looking at her. A current of feeling filled my being. It was so strong and possessing, I had to stand up to contain it. I stood up. I let it radiate through me. I gasped at the joy of it. It was the feeling of hope. But how? I asked. Lilith looked up at me with a half smile. Yes, she said, tilting her head to one side. How? So that was the initial meeting of Aurelia and Lilith. And she goes on to have a daughter, Aurelia, who she names Lilith in the book. And then Lilith is a pretty big character in this book. All right, so should we get on to the experiential part of the evening? Mm-hmm. So this is chapter 7, Lilith is the Shadow Woman. Maybe I'll, so do people have notebooks? Because if you don't, I brought pieces of paper. Okay. And some pens. I'm going to pass around if you need paper and pen. We're going to do a little exercise. Jim might know.
Available
yeah.
at many rivers.
Yeah. Yeah. About Sumer. I'm sure I can Google that.
Sitchkin.
Wasn't it? Who wrote about it?
Oh, I thought, well, do you have the Wolfenstein?
Yeah.
When you have Diane Wolfenstein,
can
you say it?
Yeah. When was that first found in literature?
I don't know if there's an earlier than the Sumerian of Lilith, but they have found it written on a lot of the early. Well, also they found it like as a talisman or to keep evil eye away. Mm-hmm. Kind of written, don't come here. Mm-hmm. They think that was later than the Sumerian. But in the end of this book, I do have some books that I did use for research that would have that information, especially this Sigmund Hurwitz book, Lilith, the First Eve. He really has a lot of that kind of information in it.
So does every chapter have the ritual in it?
Every chapter is kind of set up like the one I'm going to read, where I talk a little bit about, like, she's a shadow woman in this one, so I'm just talking a little bit about what that means, and then there's a ritual. So every chapter is set up that way. Yes. Thank you. Lilith is the Shadow Woman. Robert Johnson states in Owning Your Own Shadow that some of the pure gold of our personality is relegated to the shadow because it can find no place in that great leveling process that is culture. For women, this seems to be especially true. The definition of what is viewed as acceptable female behavior is so restrictive, the boxes we force ourselves into so tiny, that we must send most of ourselves away. Because use of the more powerful parts of our personalities may feel dangerous or threatening, women will quite often hide them within the protective shelter of their shadows. Unfortunately, these can include her strength, her intellect, her wisdom, and her intuition. Because we women feel inclined to keep ourselves small, we carry large shadows. Because we are afraid to own the contents of our shadows, we cannot become whole. Because we do not own them, they possess us. What we fear and therefore deny or repress becomes our shadow. One of the largest misconceptions still pervading the Western world is that our shadows possess only negative things, that the shadow is necessarily evil. The shadow, so often perceived as evil, demonic, or frightening, is in fact merely an absence of light. What we refer to as our dark side is only that which we do not let others see, what we do not wish to acknowledge about ourselves. Our shadows, those disowned parts of ourselves that fill the air surrounding us, are comprised merely of the things we perceive to be or have been, both directly and indirectly, taught are unacceptable, threatening. That does not mean they are necessarily bad. They could just as easily be positive things. Quite often, the most vital, interesting, the very essence of a person is banished to her darkness. Energy will, must move. What is pushed down and rejected, denied, will go somewhere. Unless we do conscious work on it, the shadow is almost always projected. That is, it is neatly laid on someone or something else, so we do not have to take responsibility for it. Since shadows are the driving force behind projections, the things which allow us to place blame and thereby not take responsibility or be moved to action, they are the perfect tool for any oppressor. A woman who is afraid of her own power will hate a powerful woman. A woman who has pushed down her intellect will be jealous of a woman who displays hers. To keep our own power dead, we need to kill the power in each other. This takes up our time, uses all of our energy, and keeps us eternally busy. A common theme in what remains of the myths and stories of the goddess is that of a female character making a descent into the underworld. There she meets a dark sister whom she must assimilate. Indeed, many feminist scholars have suggested that the female quest is an inward journey, a trip through the labyrinthine course of the soul. Psychological health is only possible through the integration of the many parts of the self. It is in the journey through her own underworld that a woman meets her unaccepted selves and begins to integrate them. So, now we're moving on to the ritual. It's the ritual of the golden shadow. And so, again, I'm welcoming the men to I just really want to see how you want to do this ritual. But if you feel you want to discuss it before we start, we can do that too. Because it's directed toward women, but I'm sure you could get creative. But it might be fun to talk about it too. So, ritual of the golden shadow. How about letting yourself be smart? How about letting yourself have a voice? How about believing in yourself? How about owning your own misery and your own jealousy and your own small self when it shows up? How about letting yourself be whole? How about letting yourself be golden? Who is locked up in your shadow? You can easily find out by looking at what you don't like in other women who push your buttons. Make a list of those buttons. If you want to be creative, you can draw them as buttons and color them, cut them out, and hang them up. However you want to interact with your own buttons is your choice. These are your buttons, no one else's. What are the buttons telling you about you? Slowly, by owning them as your own, you will remove the buttons one by one. Soon there are none left to push. New ones will surely appear. Notice them and look at them. What do they want? What are they trying to tell you about you? This is your shadow material. Your shadow is a rich garden of information for you. Let it shine. Polish it golden. Let it be reflective rather than absorbent. Let it come out and play. So we can take, you know, like 5 minutes now if people just want to write down, think of, call up for the women, a woman that pushes your buttons, you know, just be honest. What is it about her that pushes your buttons? And see if this reveals to you something about your own shadow or something that you would like to own in yourself or something you're not allowing yourself. Anyway. And do you guys want to talk about so the men, it could be, you know, if you want to do other men or I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah?
Yeah? So the same thing, but just... Okay. Okay. All right. Have fun. There's plenty more paper if you need more. Yeah.
Do you want this chair? I think it's better for her if I stand up right now.
Okay. Do you need a pen?
Yes, please. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay, everybody got it? Okay. Okay, so what do you think of your own shadow? Mine's pretty awesome. I really liked how, you know, when I wrote down what pushed my buttons, it was all things I like about myself.
What do you like about yourself?
Yeah, I'm like, huh, interesting. But I... anyway, it was surprising. It's like, well... Or that, you know, that I know that, anyway, what was other people's experience? What was other, anybody else want to talk about?
So Sarah Palin was my model.
Oh my God.
And what comes up for me is that I really dislike women who buy into the men, male, blah, blah. And, and willingly putting herself up there as MILF. Really, really just bothers me. And it comes down to, I see that as a coping mechanism that these abused beings have adopted to deal with the current cultural norms. And rather than have any sort of compassionate response, I pretty much want to snuff them out. So it's obviously probably some growth potential there. Because I would like them to be strong and claim their full existence and power. But they're so tightly bound in, I don't see how to even get them to notice if they've given it all up. So it just, that's what bugs me. There's my button.
So is there a way in which that you feel that way about yourself?
No. Maybe I haven't figured out where I've bought in and where I haven't. So some part of me has bought in and I don't even know where it is yet. So, food for thought. Disturbing food for thought.
Well, we all are co-opted. I mean, we don't. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, how would you be any other way? I mean, I actually don't have a model to be different than that. All I kind of intuit is that this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't actually know what right is. So.
Interesting. All right.
Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth
Warren,
actually.
Anybody else want to share?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I look at my list, I think that these are things that I don't allow myself to do.
Mm-hmm.
Cold, unapproachable, taken care of or dependent on a man. Outwardly, flauntingly sexual, like flaunting sexuality. Women who don't like other women or who are male identified or aloof. Competitive. Consumers, like into materialism and boisterous and pushy.
So you feel you don't allow yourself those things, but is there some way in which you would want freedom to be able to be that way too?
Yeah, at times. I mean,
that's interesting. Yeah, because I mean, the thing is, I feel like they wouldn't push our buttons if there wasn't something in there for us. So I liked the idea of hanging them on the fridge even, and so then you could really work with it. Mm-hmm. Like, what is it about that? It's bothering me. Mm-hmm. They can do whatever they want, right? I mean,
just play with it. And the same for you. You know, I think it's just really interesting.
It's also interesting that you teach voice, which is all about expression.
Mm-hmm.
And yet if it's over-expressed, mm-hmm. you're kind of reacting. So it's interesting.
Oh, I can totally, what's the word, encourage other people to do what I can't seem to myself do.
They say
about
teachers, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's true for a lot of us. Anybody else?
Teachers, I'm a teacher too, it's an occupational hazard.
Oh yeah?
My list is very similar to yours.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I find that some of those things that are on my list are things that I used to identify with and have worked really hard not to be anymore. You know? Mm-hmm. I work really hard not to be abrasive and cold and aloof. I work really hard. You know? So it does irk me when I find other women so unapproachable. It's hard for me, and because I do recognize that part of that is part of my shadow self.
Mm-hmm.
I am that. It's almost a comfort zone for me to
uh-huh.
be unapproachable. So my medicine.
You know,
mm-hmm. I think there's also from wounding.
From wounding.
Well, just the stereotype of women is warmth,
mm-hmm.
and so if you're going to express strength, which is often interpreted when incarnated through a female form. As cold and aloof.
Mm.
So it could be a rejection of strength and a desire, but warmth is actually the model we're supposed to fall in, rather than actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was thinking, I'm looking at the, so one of the things I found was, something that I could relate to myself as part of a history of having been treated a certain way and therefore not sort of a wounding reaction,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you see other people acting that way and particularly women. Particularly a hierarchy, you know, of better than thou somehow, either by looks, by weight, by money, by clothes,
mm-hmm.
by, you know, all the many millions of things that women are told they have to be or have or all of these things, that there's that sense of not good enough no matter what,
mm-hmm.
which also reflects back to all of us in terms of wounding, because those, all of that got taught. We all went through that, of learning those things. So it's kind of those, when I see people that overtly act that way, it bothers me.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah. For what it's like.
Yeah. How about some of the men?
Well, as a male, my shadow has a lot to do with entitlement. And being white and male. And also having, so the other side of that is I was a woman and so there is that place back there. I don't know if that's the darkness or the lightness. But having that one white male entitlement and power implied.
So how does that get projected?
Cockiness.
Hmm.
Good word.
Yeah.
That's good enough.
That sums it up. Any other men want to share their experience? No?
I like the word entitlement a lot. Because it really, I saw a person who had once where
where the woman described herself as allergic to pretense and entitlement.
That's great.
That's fabulous. I fell in love instantly. Just yeah. Yeah. And I was going to say that. So it was real interesting to hear you come up with the word. Yeah.
Well, how about I read the last chapter? It's really short, but it's kind of. It can be the conclusion, and then we might have time for a couple closing comments from people, if you have them. So, okay, so this was like 23 years later, after I met the owl, that I got to this. I like to say that ahas and no does are sometimes very close. Like sometimes you say aha, and then but it's like, why didn't I get that? It's such a no duh. Like I should have gotten that years ago. I'm just getting it now. So sometimes aha moments are really close to no duh moments. No-duh. Does that make sense? Like mm-hmm. no duh, you know, like why didn't you know that? Uh-oh. Right? It's like, oh, I get it, and then you're like, what took you so long? Right? So aha and no duh. That was one of those. This was one of those moments. So, in his book, this is Lilith is a Strega. In his book Lilith, the First Eve, Sigmund Hurwitz traces the linguistic connection between Lilith, the owl, and the words Striga, Strix, and Stringe. Strix is literally the word for a screech owl. Ancient and classical cultures believed the Strix. I'm probably saying these all wrong, sorry. Stringe and Striga to be demonic beings associated with owls. They fly at night in the guise of birds to the cradles of children and suck their blood. In all languages, so to speak, the word means a witch on the one hand and a predatory night owl on the other. That's a quote from Hurwitz. In Italian, the word Strega, the word becomes Strega. Hurwitz states, in Italian, the word strega means something akin to an evil old woman or witch who is in league with the devil. That's a quote again from Hurwitz. Sounds like how Lilith is typically described. After I wrote my two Crete novels, I decided to pursue a family legend I had been told about since my days as a child, that my Italian great-grandmother was a strega. A strega, in fact, is not an evil old woman or a woman in line with dark forces, the same as Lilith is not a child killer or a demon. A strega is a medicine woman. My great-grandmother was a medicine woman in the Italian tradition. This lineage was lost to my family. I had a few small fragments and memories to go on. She was a midwife, a healer, a doctor, an herbalist. She knew how to cure the evil eye. It was difficult for her when she moved here because all the plants were different. To find out more, I decided to write a book about her. My novel, The Strega and the Dreamer, is the result of that effort. In doing this research, I connected to my great-grandmother and restored the lineage to my family. I am now a Strega, just like Lilith and my great-grandmother. It is clear to me now that Lilith came to lead me on a journey to become a medicine woman in the tradition of my own lineage. It is beautifully eloquent. I am so glad I did not send her away. What might Lilith want to lead you back to? I encourage you to trust her and take the journey.
Great.
So that was, yeah, it was my aha, no dumb. Oh, Lilith's a Striga.
20 years,
okay.
Sometimes it just takes a while.
Yeah, so any last comments or questions before
we... Do you think
we
these visitations sometimes should come in dreams? Dream form?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people have them in dream form. I tend to have more of the visitation type, but yeah. Any thoughts?
It's my husband. He's making decisions. No, no, I'm ignoring.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. The only thing was is, you know, I don't. I've never read anything by you. I was just totally drawn by the description of your work and your writing and who you are. And I'm full-blooded Sicilian.
Oh.
I feel like in many ways I've turned my back on my lineage because of the patriarchal energy. So it's, I grew up in a very, very heavily patriarchal family, and women being squashed and their spirits and souls being squashed.
Mm-hmm.
And their bodies. And I'm still working with that. But there are just so many things about you and your work that really resonated with me. And I did a vision quest about a little less than 6 months ago and spent my solo time of 4 days with rattlesnakes.
Wow.
And I've never been afraid of snakes, so I have a healthy respect for them, of course, especially the poisonous ones. And it, but it was a really an amazing experience for me, because I knew that I was there for the transmutation of the poison that I still carry
mm-hmm.
from my childhood. And so I just am grateful for your, what you shared tonight. And would like to connect with you.
Yeah, thank you. That's
you
wonderful.
The Strike and the Dreamer.
That's what it sounds like.
Well, and
the
other two are about a snake priestess, so.
Right, right.
And it's interesting because the village where my family's from is in the Abruzzi.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're right next to Coculo, which is the place where they throw this. It's famous for its snake charmers. But now that's kind of been reduced into this feast of San Domenico, and they throw the snakes at the statue as they're leading it through the town. But it was huge. The snake thing is huge there.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, and I didn't know that till after I wrote the two Crete novels.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how these things just kind of keep trying to find us. And I definitely see the snake and the bird as kind of two halves of one whole.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love to connect, yeah. Thank you for coming.
I want to mention that Teresa's path as a Strega is also working as a diviner. And her specialty, after seeing a number of people in the field, is helping people reconnect with their lineages. So there's a lot of amazing ancestor work that comes through mm-hmm. with her, and even if there's no living beings that are practicing that, the information comes through, so mm-hmm. it's definitely a gift that she shares with the community.
Thank you, Sarah. Sarah's also a diviner, I would like to mention. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, are we good?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for coming. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you so much on behalf of Many Rivers. And I want to point out that we have a donation bowl over on the counter there, and we encourage you to contribute to it. Half of that is shared with our speakers so that they can further their own work, and we retain the other half to maintain this space for future such events. Do come to the party next week, Friday, if you're going to be around. We'd love to see you and enjoy some free tea and a sale. And I don't know if there's any other events or anything like that that you wanted to publicize or anywhere. Contact information. Is there you have a sign up sheet or anything like that?
I can quickly create one if people want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and don't forget Teresa's books over here at the door as you to check them out as you go out. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
So.